Hey, y'all. Sam Sanders here. One thing I know about interviewing celebrities, big and small, is that they are rarely on time.
You're on time.
I'm on time.
They're
I'm
never on time. This is awesome. Look at that. It worked.
Did it work?
I'm totally discombobulated.
Like, oh, what am I going to do?
What do we do now? I'll see you later.
All right.
Jordan Klepper, the comedian and Daily Show correspondent, he was on time when I met up with him in a conference room at Comedy Central a few weeks ago.
Thank you.
Sam, right?
Yes.
Nice to meet you, sir.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah. Should be fun.
It'll be fun.
I was there to talk to Jordan about a new hour-long special airing on Comedy Central this Sunday at 10 p.m. Eastern. It's a documentary about gun violence in America. It took him all over the country, to the woods of Georgia, where he hung out with some big-time Second Amendment folks, a militia, you could say. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about Jordan taking over the 11:30 time slot on Comedy Central this fall with his own show right after The Daily Show. This is the same time slot that was once occupied by Stephen Colbert and Larry Wilmore. And, of course, we'll talk about Jordan's time at The Daily Show. All right, that should get you started. Enjoy. Can I call you Cold Brew?
Cold Brew? Please call me Cold Brew. Yeah, I'd love that.
For those that don't know, what's that about?
Cold Brew is the nickname I was given by the Georgia State Militia. Everybody there goes by a nickname. There was Blood Agent. There was Kill Zone. And so I wanted to fit in. So I asked them to give me a nickname. I threw one out, which was Cold Brew. They gave it to me. And they actually called me Cold Brew for my day of training with the militia.
What are the characteristics of someone in a militia codenamed Cold Brew?
That characteristic is very specific. It's a person who's from Kalamazoo, who then moved to Chicago and then moved to New York and then went into the bowels of Georgia to do a special on guns.
We're going to talk more about the special.
Yep.
But why don't I just talk about like your busy year? You've got a lot of things going on. You've got your new show coming out. You've got the special. Are you still the Caucasian correspondent in spite of the new show?
I you know what? I've decided to never relinquish that title. I am still senior Caucasian at The Daily Show. I'm going to take that over with me. I'm going to be the senior Caucasian at my own show as well. It's a point of pride, and it's just easy to identify me that way. It's like, oh, that's the big white guy? All right, yeah, he's done. Now I know who he is.
How tall are you?
I'm 6'4".
Damn it.
So I'm not quite Comey level, but I'm up there.
Close enough.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess what I've been asking all the folks that I speak with now since November, was it 8th? Like, how are you taking care of yourself? It seems as if whether you were for Trump or against Trump or involved in politics or not, the ongoing news cycles of Trump and Russia and crazy have become a big part of people's, like, everyday life. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that? How do you take care of yourself in spite of it when you have a job kind of that feeds on it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I luck out in that sense. My job is responding to that. So there's no shortage of stimuli going on when it comes to the Trump era that we live in. So I get up, I'm addicted to my phone, and I get to go to work. I get to bounce off any brand new ideas that happen at the beginning of the day or near the end of the day, and then get to filter it through that. But it is I think you speak to a fascinating cultural shift. No matter which side you're on, I know I felt something that I hadn't felt on my 30-some-odd years on this planet, at least in America, over this since November. Like, we are really all looking at the same thing.
Yes.
And how we see it is sort of a Rorschach test for perhaps how you see greater trends in America. But that is something that I've never felt as much, that you walk down the street and it feels like everybody's thinking about the same thing, good or bad. It's like, oh, it's that we're all paying attention to the same game.
Totally. And it's like, I feel like, I don't know, like, I've been obsessed with this idea for years that, like, the idea of a monoculture was gone away. Mm-hmm. Like, the idea of all of us watching the same Michael Jackson video or the same this or that, like, that's over with the internet and this and that. And it's like, no, Donald Trump has reintroduced the monoculture. Yep. And, like, in the same way that we, like, everyone sat down and watched the Thriller video for the first time, kind of together, mm-hmm. We do that every day with Donald Trump, but no one's dancing. There is no music.
Every day is like a Walking Dead premiere, you know? And I think that could be a metaphor or not. But I think you are right. They talked about the royal family was an important part of English culture for so long and perhaps still is because they needed something to gossip about. It was that monoculture that you respond to, that it does feel like we were moving away from that. We aren't anymore.
We're going to talk a lot about this, but at the end of your special, you highlight groups and people that are working to end gun violence, and you say, hey, reach out to them, go to their website, check them out. that was something that I did not expect to see. How did that come about, and what has been the response to that ender?
Well, I would say in getting to do a special on the gun debate, like this gun debate feels so fractured right now, but there are so many points of commonality in the gun debate that constantly struck me, and you realize so many people want there to be less gun violence, less gun deaths on both sides of the aisle. But it became really depressing working on this thing for months on months on end, and we were looking for what is the ending. Mm-hmm. And in all honesty, we started talking to a bunch of different groups, and there are people out there who are actively trying to make something happen. Anything, whether that's on the political side of petitioning your governmental officials, or whether that's just functional, like there was a guy who knows how to play guitar, and he's like, I want to teach guitar in areas of the country where there might be gun violence or there's just violence on the streets. I want to help with an after-school program. And to me, that was a really potent, effective thing. It's not going to change 1,000 lives, but it might change one. It's saving one person's life. That means the world to that person's family, that person's friends. And I think there are people who are like, well, fuck it. If I can't save the 33,000 people who die, I can maybe save one, and so I'm going to get started. So I think that's where we're like, let's find people who are doing something, whether they're political or non-political, who's doing something, and let's point to them.
Yeah. Who is this special for? As I was watching it, mm-hmm. I was thinking of the typical demo for your network's content, mm-hmm. and then maybe some of the moderates and conservatives that you might want to hear it or see it. Is it going to get to them? I mean, how do you know that this reaches the right people?
I mean, I think we had a big discussion about this. Like, The Daily Show has its own very specific demographic, a liberal demographic as well. But I think what we found interesting about the gun debate was, like, these moderates in the middle, like, and highlighting how many people agreed on the same things. So I was like, can we hopefully reach out to more than just the people who are going to clap for speaking a left agenda, let's say. And so hopefully we attempted to poke fun at some of the self-righteousness of the left as well, as a way
what?
To point
the
out.
Left? The left?
I mean, I don't... this is a podcast. I forgot
who
I'm talking
to.
This is an NPR podcast. Are you kidding me? I'm sorry. I need to remember my audience.
We'll scratch that.
Okay, good.
It's fine. Go ahead.
I think we wanted to poke holes in both sides. To one, to take some of the air out of the room. And two, to show that, like, if we really look at it, there is a middle ground. I would love it. I really do hope that it reaches out to some people who have different perspectives, who are more on the right. And that was a purpose, a big part of it is like, I want to go to the middle of the country where I'm from, Michigan. I want to talk to gun owners. I want to talk to people who train people with guns. I want to talk to people who had experiences with guns and don't see them as an evil. And I'd like not to vilify them. I'd like to show that they are pretty normal.
So like, there's this portion, well, there are a few portions of the special where I'm watching you interact with the folks that are in it. And I kept saying to myself, what did he tell them before they started filming? Is he saying this will be a satire? This will be straight ahead? Because this is my constant question of so much of Comedy Central content. Like, what's the preamble for this? How much can you share of that?
we're very open with everybody there. I think they know that they're doing a special for Comedy Central.
Okay.
And we say, here's the deal. We want to talk about guns. We want to talk about all sides of the issue. We ask that you be open to it. It will be on Comedy Central, so I might have some fun in those ways, but we ask that you just be yourself and speak from your point of view. And then we just start and we start talking. I think we're looking to have the most earnest conversation that we can. And there are parts where I am playing a character. And I think at its most effective, I play a character and that elicits a more earnest, interesting response from other people. And so I think there are those moments. I don't think the people in the Bachelor segment, for example, there's a segment in the special where I do try to find a moderate gun mind to change. And
I thought you were going to pick the black guy.
He's great, right?
He was great.
Rick is awesome.
No.
And then I went with my cousin. Spoiler alert. He signed the release, you know, yeah. So he's going to do it, you know? Like, I think that was a point where, you know, the conceit that we did have, it was like, I want to talk to a bunch of moderates and comically, moderates are really down the middle and don't make for good TV. So let's frame it in a way in which Americans love to digest how you choose somebody. So we take it and we put it in a Bachelor setting. Now, that is something we didn't talk to the moderates about beforehand. So I kind of just earnestly. We told them this is going to feel a little bit like reality television. I want to have like off-the-cuff conversations with you. I want you guys to socialize with one another, and let's go from there. And I think that makes for, it made for a very interesting day of shooting. I think some people were more guarded. Some people were unsure about what we were trying to do. And I think that's completely fair. I think there were some people who were unhappy with the way in which it was going. I hope that everybody left feeling happy about the way that they were talked to and portrayed. And even at the end, as I'm like coming down and we did a few more of the Bachelor style things, they kind of got what was going on. And honestly, I think really then enjoyed it as well, yeah, to be in on what that context is. And so hopefully, as an audience member, I'd love you to empathize with those Midwesterners right there who are just like, yeah, I'll listen to this guy. He's a buffoon who came in from New York trying to do all these ridiculous things, and I still have an open mind to hear, which I think those are like the heroes of this special.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are lots of things and moments in the special where I learned this, a new thing that I had never thought of before, never even imagined could be a reality. There's this part where you end up at this place where there can be no computers. Mm-hmm. Explain that. What the hell is that about? It's so crazy.
It's nuts. There is a place called the National Tracing Center that is part of the ATF, and their job is to collect records from closed down gun stores so that when a gun is used in a crime, and if they need to track where that gun is to try to find the person who maybe used that gun, and they need to find out who bought that gun, legally bought that gun, is it illegal, the ATF needs to trace it. And there's a center that holds all of those records. But what you quickly realize is that center isn't allowed to legally take those paper records and put them on a computer that is searchable. So that
center, because that would be a database.
Because that would be, they would consider that a database, and the NRA has pushed to not allow any searchable databases.
It
is of gun owners. Because there is fear that is, oh, once you have a listing of gun owners that is electronic, then you will be able to take everybody's guns. Now, you can legally have these. If you need to purchase a gun, you need to fill this thing out. And the NRA is not against people searching for guns that were used in a crime. They're just against trying to make it easy for ATF agents. So this special kind of explored that. We even went to the agency. It's an incredible space because it's such hardworking governmental employees in a giant place in the middle of Virginia that's using microfiche machines. They have so many files that their floor is threatening to collapse. They have to keep them outside in giant storage bins. And you just see, this is the bureaucracy that Americans are dealing with. Like, if a gun is used in a crime and they want to figure out who owned that gun, how do we catch this person before they do something again? And you think it's going to work like your favorite crime drama, where they put it into a system, they figure it out, and this is so-and-so.
Minority Report, big computer screen. Bam, nope. No.
That goes right to Virginia and to a lady who has got a 500 other ones she's going through. She's going blind on her microfiche machine. And I think this was something that was outrageous to us, seeing this, because it's Americans making it harder on other Americans to do what we all kind of agree is okay. Like, why are we have an ATF for a reason. We want to stop crimes from happening. If you think it's okay for us to try to track down where these guns are, why are we acting like we have the technology of the 70s? It's because the NRA stopped it. They put into fear with this idea that America's coming for your guns, which, spoiler alert, Americans still have their guns, more guns than any other place on earth. But the fear is still there, which means the bureaucracy lives and nobody's willing to touch it. So I think it was a perfect example for us of like, look at the bullshit that we're having to deal with. Nobody in America wants this, but one lobbying group is pushing for it, and they got it.
And like, one of the main points of this special, you find that these moderates you're dealing with, they want some of the same things that liberals want in terms of background checks, et cetera. Most of America agrees on a few basic measures, and the NRA is just stuck, right? Mm-hmm. So knowing that, I mean, like, did you go into this or leave the process of making it saying, it's effed anyway?
I think I left, the optimism I left with was how much common ground there really was. And that even the people who are the most strident gun owners, who might be frustrated with the special and maybe left not the biggest fan of my own, they still supported common sense gun control. Like, a gun owner who is trained and who feels they should go out into public and have a gun on them, they don't want other non-trained people with guns out there in the public. They don't want guns in the hands of people who are mentally unstable. They want guns to be in the hands of people who are safe and as responsible as they tend to be. But what becomes the problem is that's not the debate we are having. Like, the debate gets thrown into hyperbole, and so the NRA can say they're coming for your guns and they're going to take away our one right. Well, I don't think that's what's happening on the left, but it feels like there's just those two sides. And so that was very disheartening to see. But I think in order to break these systems down, you have to learn about those systems. And the NRA is really good at some things. Like, the NRA is incredibly good at organization. They are very local. And if you are a group that's pushing against it, you have to be local. You have to worry about your state reps. That's what the NRA worries about. They are very passionate. And it's because they take the idea of guns, they make the topic of guns about family, about loyalty, and about patriotism. And
who says no to that?
Nobody says no to that, right? And so, you know, liberals try to push back on, like, well, what about, this is about waiting periods. It's like
no, patriotism. No,
it's about patriotism, because we all can agree on waiting periods. It's like, oh, should we, a couple days, is that all right? It's going to make the world a little bit safer. Everybody's on board with that. But yeah, you make it about patriotism, and now you're fighting, now it's a First versus a Second Amendment thing. It's like, oh, now you've already lost the battle.
So you're a comedian. We just spent the last several minutes talking about gun policy. I wouldn't even say it's a new era anymore, but, like, comic as more than a comic, you know? I mean, The Daily Show and onward, there are comedians that are part of the public discourse around politics in a way, I don't know, that you wouldn't have seen X number of years ago. Is this a new thing? Is it an old thing? Or do you ever get pushback of folks saying, just be funny, dude. Just stop. Just be funny.
Sure. I mean, I don't think it's not a new thing. I think comedy at its heart is reflecting what is going on. I think the most successful comedy is commenting on a shared experience and having perhaps an interesting take on that. I think the stuff I've always been drawn to, like, it doesn't always have to be political. I love Nichols and May back when I was in Chicago, because they were satirizing how human beings were dealing with the 60s and how relationships were. I think, like, that's more social. It could also then skew political. Lenny Bruce and everybody is constantly talking about our times. In the monoculture that you referenced, like, we are all responding to a time that feels very new to us, that feels maybe dangerous to some, that feels exciting to others, but it is a shared experience. And I think comedians are going to use the world around them to comment on it. And I think that's the thing to talk about right now. And I think you speak to this idea of, like, just be funny. I get that. Like, I don't want to be seen as a journalist. I am not a journalist. I'm a comedian.
You should try it.
It's easy. Is it simple?
So funny.
You just show up with a microphone, start talking. All right, maybe I am a journalist. Yeah. This is easy. Like, I think as a comedian, my job is to be funny. But also as a human being, my job is to be honest to the stuff that I see. I think that's what we're all trying to do with whatever our jobs are, whatever art we try to do, is like, reflect something that you give a shit about. And so guess what people give a shit about right now?
Yeah, yeah. I guess this is a good moment to talk about your new show. How much of this new show can you share with folks?
Right now, we're keeping it top secret. So,
okay.
But I can tell you, it's going to be political. We're responding to what's happening. As you can see, the world is in a little bit of a tailspin. So we're going to grab onto that tail, and we're gonna go down in that blaze of glory.
So you're entering a really crowded marketplace. Mm-hmm. There's all the late night guys that have gotten really political. There's all your colleagues on Comedy Central that are doing their thing. How do you create a space in the midst of such an abundance of this kind of content right now?
I mean, I think there's so much great content out there, and I think I'm honestly humbled by the peers that I'm going to get to share some of those time spots with. I think that is the question, is like, what do I bring that is unique, and how can I attack this from an angle that we're not seeing on the other shows? I think that's our number one goal, is like, let's take a look at these stories, but from a different angle. Let's bring what I hopefully think I do best, but can also feel like it stands out from what I've been doing at 11 o'clock. And so right now we work with Trevor's EPing on the show as well, which is great because we do want the 11:30 show to feel somewhat like a companion. So it's not just an extension. It's like, at some points, a counterpoint. At some
Ebony
points,
and Ivory.
There you go, right?
Ebony and Ivory.
It's
yeah.
Ebony and Ivory. I'd like to be Michael Jackson in that situation.
Who wouldn't?
Right?
Paul McCartney was always weird.
Yeah?
But I have a weird thing with Paul McCartney. I actually like Wings better.
Wings is pretty darn
Wings
fun.
Wings is effing awesome.
Wings is a real fun one to go back to.
Yes. I agree.
What is the big Wings song?
Yes.
Band on the Run is the weirdest song I've maybe ever heard. It's three different songs put into one, and it's beautiful, and it's strange, and it's talking about a band that is running. It feels like a James Bond theme. It feels like a little bit of everything.
And that's what I want.
That's what I want.
I want some crazy.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So your show is going to be The Wings?
Yeah. For... I'd like, yeah, exactly. I'm leaving the Beatles to start Wings. That's
awesome. Give me your life story in 2 minutes.
How my life story
here. Kalamazoo plays a part. What were the steps that got you to Comedy Central?
Born and bred Kalamazoo kid, who was a nerd, but then found that he liked doing improv comedy in college. At Kalamazoo College, where I did improv because I thought Ryan Stiles was the funniest guy on Comedy Central when I watched Whose Line Is It Anyway. And I was like, this thing is cool.
Which one was he on?
He's a big, tall, lanky one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, go figure. Okay. I was like, ah, that big, tall, lanky white guy. Yeah, what's his deal? It's like, all right, that. I want to do more of that. I found that to be the most exciting, fun thing after college, to do improv and to do comedy. So I went to Chicago to study and figure out how all of that worked. I did the Second City and Improv Olympic there. I worked for the Big Ten Network because I loved Michigan football and worked on all of that. And then decided to move to New York City with my then girlfriend, now wife, who is awesome, Laura Gray. We did comedy in New York City. We did the Upright Citizens Brigade. We did stuff together as well. And then I got plucked to be on The Daily Show, which was a dream job. And got to work on that with Mr. Jon Stewart for a year and a half. And then Mr. Trevor Noah comes on in and continues to be a dream job. And then, boom, I get to do a gun special. My wife gets to work on that as well. She was the head writer on that, and that was great. And then they're like, do an 11:30 show. And I'm like, hell yeah, this thing is killing it. So a pretty happy life. I would say also within those 2 minutes of what my life story is, I was super lucky to have a lot of great people help me and support me all along the way, because it ain't easy. In that time period of let's do comedy and let's get 11:30 show, there's about 17 years. And so there's a lot of stuff in there that that took some hustle, but a lot of people were pretty helpful along the way.
Including Tim Allen.
including Tim Allen, yes.
Who was, I want to get this right. He was your father's college roommate for a bit and introduced your father to your mother.
Yes, because he's my mother's cousin. So I would say Tim is a supportive guy and has been helpful. That was the best thing he did for me, is he created the connection between my mother and my father so that they then had me. Then they went on to be amazing, supportive, awesome people. And Tim went on to become the Tool Man Taylor.
Tim the Tool Man Taylor.
Let me tell you.
He gave us JTT.
He really did. He birthed us JTT.
What makes you the most nervous about this new show?
I think I'm going to ask a bunch of my friends and colleagues to work on a show that's got my name on it. And I think that's, honestly, I couldn't be more thrilled and humbled to have that experience. I think what makes me nervous is, like, I don't want to let those people down. And so I think it becomes, how do I carve something out that feels original and necessary?
Yeah.
I mean, The Daily Show was a dream job for me, and not only because it was something I wanted to be a part of since I was watching The Daily Show 16 years ago, but beyond that, like, it's such a great place to work, and
it's
so good. Like, people talked about when I got there, it was like, you can't be an asshole and work there, and there have been, don't get me wrong, but we put on like 140 shows a year, and it's exhausting, and if you are a problem on one show, you do another show the next day, and eventually you just have to weed those people out because you can't be drama. And so it makes for a place of, like, really passionate, smart people who know how to work together because they have to work together in such an intense environment. And so I think I learned a ton from John and how he put that environment together, and, like, also a ton from Trevor, who, like, came into an environment that was already created and, like, alien to him, and he immediately, like, made it his own, and also has, like, a totally different energy than John, but is also so open and kind. And what has retained with that show is it's still a place that you feel so comfortable and love. And I think that's, I'm truly saddened to have to leave that, but excited about trying to figure out how to create that in my own little world.
Did Trevor or John or Colbert haze you as you get ready for this new role, give you advice? Like, what is it? Because you're in this, like, club of, like, the dudes with the shows.
The dudes with the... I've talked with Trevor and John extensively about it. Trevor, you know, from the get-go has been so supportive of that and wanting to help me do that. What they don't tell you when you get a show is, yeah, you have to do a funny show and talk about the news and all that big stuff. You also have to put together and run a business, and that's big. You have to hire 100 people. You have to figure out an infrastructure, figure out how a day works, figure out a space where you're going to do it. And so...
it's like running a campaign for president.
It's like running a campaign for president. You're like, oh, I thought I just had to figure out how to fix healthcare. Done. They're like, no, you have to campaign for president. So that's where, like, Trevor and John have been really helpful, not only in, like, the creative parts, but it was like, hey, how do you...
Pro tip, campaign more in Wisconsin.
That's what it is, right? That's why I'm going to set this in Wisconsin or Michigan. Yeah. And then it should be successful, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Speaking of campaign, so you covered Trump rallies a bit. Mm-hmm. I covered my fair share of Trump rallies. What did you find the most surprising about that?
How impressive they were. They were, people cared a ton at those rallies. And I think it's easy to sit up in New York and be like, he's popular, but he's not that popular. And you show up,
maybe he is.
He's that popular. And I think, you know, we were all duped, although I don't take a ton of responsibility for it. I don't know whose job it is to give total perspective. I mean, I think we kept being told that this was a small percentage. But what was there, and the writing was on the wall, is like, people really do believe in Donald Trump and are looking for somebody who feels outside of the system. And I think I went to so many of those rallies and to those both inside and outside, and people are lining up around the block. Even afterwards, I went to a couple of his post-campaign rallies, his I'm president rallies.
Although, you know what? If I could do that, I'd do it too.
Yeah.
I could just go out every day and be like, thousands of people are going to come and chant my name.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah.
So you went to those.
I went to those. And I mean, you want to be like, well, now that he's president, like, people aren't going to show up and line all around the block. Like, oh my, I went to Nashville and there were lines just as far as the eye can see. It's like, I say it kind of jokingly, but it is a big reminder that, like, don't underestimate the power of what this guy has said. And you see it, people love and they care, and he's their guy.
Yeah. No, it's funny thinking about those rallies, because, like, well, one, people were always very nice to me. Like, the one time felt physically afraid was when Bernie lost California, because those liberals are ready to fight.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, thinking about Trump and the rallies and, like, why they work, it's like, you know, when you go to a Trump rally that you're going to get a show, and there's going to be the moment where he's chants build the wall, the moment where he, like, recites the snake, the moment where, like, you get to do a call and response. It's like going to a Beyonce concert being like, she's going to sing Irreplaceable soon. It's coming. It's happening. And then it happens. It's the same song that you've heard 1,000 times.
That's you came to hear the hits.
Yes. He gives you the hits. Name a Hillary Clinton hit.
Yeah. All I could say is Benghazi, and I think that's a Trump song.
Oh!
I always felt like that with Trump. I was like, Trump gives you a chorus, and I think you need a chorus.
Yes.
And we think you're deep in the political world, and you're like, yeah, but he did this little thing here, and he pivoted, blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, people are listening for the hook. And Trump is great at the hook. And it's infuriating sometimes.
He's a political chain smokers.
he is a political chain smokers. He really is. And he's number one on the Billboard charts.
Oh, yeah. All right, I'm sure you have very important things to do. You are a tall man with a blazer on, which means you have a lot of important things to do right now.
Oh, my God.
I want you to do those. Thank you so much. This was a pleasure.
Seth.
I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, man.
Jordan Klepper, thanks so much. His special, called Jordan Klepper Solves Guns, airs Sunday night, June 11th at 10 p.m. Eastern on Comedy Central. It'll be on demand as well after that. And this episode that you just heard, it is the kind of thing that I'll be doing a lot more of in my new podcast. That will be out in the world, outside of NPR One, later on this month. I'm so excited. Keep an ear out for that. Okay, I'm Sam Sanders. Talk to you soon.